Okay, very good. Well, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation to speak here. I work from time to time on foundations of quantum mechanics, but I don't tend to take an information theoretic perspective, as will become clear in this talk. So I'm glad for the opportunity, the indulgence in any case. This work is especially, by the way, Rob, that was such a good talk. I'm in panic to match the standard, but I'll do my best. I would especially like to thank Julian Barber because, as you'll see, the key idea in this talk goes back to a conversation that Julian and I had in 1982 about Leibniz and the principle of an identity of the indiscernible, which Rob mentioned. And so I'll be making use of that principle too, but in a way that comes out more friendly for quantum mechanics. Okay, so I'm going to start by talking about locality, because to my mind, the non-locality of quantum mechanics is the most bizarre non-classical feature. And I've been thinking many different, I work also on quantum gravity, also sometimes on cosmology and quantum field theory. And locality is a persistent issue, and I'm going to try to convince you to loosen up your ideas about locality drastically during this talk. Then I'm going to talk briefly about the principle of identity of the indiscernible as a kind of heuristic principle. Then I'm going to give my assumptions. Then I'm going to give a microscopic theory of subsystems of the universe. And I'll make it clear why it's a theory of subsystems and not the whole universe. I'll derive quantum mechanics from that in a certain approximation when the number of subsystems becomes large. And then I'll talk about deviations from quantum mechanics and perhaps testing this scheme. Now, why are we here? We come to meetings on quantum foundations because we're still seeking the answer to the question that Johnny Wheeler asked in the 1960s, why the quantum? And I think it's interesting to note that there are really two roads to the answer that people pursue. And from my point of view, both of these are crucial. None of them will succeed in isolation of the other. There are interpretational approaches, and you might disagree with the nomenclature, but these are approaches that assume that the dynamics and the kinematics of quantum mechanics are fine as given and attempt to modify how we talk about them or how we think about them. And then there are dynamical approaches, which take the view that quantum mechanics is hard to understand and puzzling because it's wrong, and that the solution of the measurement problem and other puzzles is not thinking more clearly or differently, but making different physical hypotheses, which will result in a theory which will have a less problematic or bothersome interpretation. Again, I want to emphasize that from my point of view, I tend to work on the second, and what I'm going to talk to you is an example of the second kind of approach, but it's informed by the thinking of the first kind of approach. From my sense, both of these are essential and go hand in hand. They're complementary in reaching a new understanding of quantum phenomenon. Now, locality. Rob gave a much better and much clearer view of the distinction between classical, non-classical, and quantum than I could. But the part of quantum phenomena that I'm most intrigued by is non-locality, because physics is such a weird mixture of local things, information, and energy propagate on light cones, which are local, in a world which is full of quantum correlations and entanglement, which is non-local. And our puzzle is to figure out how the non-locality and the locality both arise and complement each other. Now, if you come from quantum gravity, if you think about quantum gravity as I do, and in the way that very often we at Perimeter and we who try to think more foundationally about quantum gravity think, you come to the conclusion that space is emergent. Space is not something, is not a fundamental category. Space is an emergent property of the low energy universe that governs when we're far away from catastrophic events like the Big Bang. Locality is also emergent. If space is emergent, then locality is emergent. And therefore, the distinction, the shuffling of the world into local processes and non-local correlations and non-local entanglement is an aspect of dynamics from the point of view, and a consequence of dynamics from the point of view of quantum gravity. It's not something to be written into the principles. The principles should somehow embrace both locality and non-locality and turn them and read them differently. Now we were talking in the discussion that Rob and I had about fine-tuning and naturality and so forth. And he mentioned, so I'll mention again, that Anthony Valentini likes to argue that quantum mechanics has local physics and is dominated by local propagation of information and energy because we're in a kind of equilibrium, what he calls quantum equilibrium, which is reached dynamically, and that the no signaling is a consequence of being in a dynamic equilibrium state. If we go away from that equilibrium state, as Anthony has proven rather generally, we go to a world with non-local signaling. So we can imagine, again, from a kind of quantum gravity perspective in which space is emergent and time is emergent, that also this equilibrium, which separates cleanly physics into local and non-local, is emergent, and that the local propagation of energy and information is kind of a wash in a sea of non-locality, which is, however, hidden by the equilibrium state. This is the view that Anthony and other people propagate. I know it's not a popular view for this audience, but I'm going to ask you to embrace it for a few minutes and see where it goes. We also know or have imagined here that locality is actually relative and relative to the position and motion of the observer. I'm not going to describe that, but that relative locality perspective informs the technicalities of what I'll do at one step and as part of my background. So if locality is accidental, emergent, a consequence of low energy equilibrium, there should be defects in that locality. And an important question for physics and for measurement is to isolate the defects. A defect would be events that are far away in the emergent geometry of space that are, however, causally interaction with each other, causally linked. Sabina Hassenfelder has written a couple of wonderful papers about those defects. And with Fotini Marcopulo, we showed that they're quite general consequences of a non-perturbative approach to quantum gravity. So imagine that those defects are there. How do they manifest themselves? And an intriguing question which occurs to a lot of people is that maybe defects in locality are at the root of the non-locality and the entanglement that we see in quantum phenomenon. Again, that's not a popular view which sees these things as more axiomatically, but take it as the motivation for what I'll describe. Now, I'd like to develop this a little bit in the language that Julian Barber and I were talking about more than 30 years ago in his farm and sometime in the early 80s. Consider from a Leibnizian perspective an event as defined by its relational properties, that is, by the observables which are measured there, as Lucian was discussing. Consider the view of an event. A view of an event is all the properties which are measurable there, the information that are measurable there, coming from the past, coming classically up the past light cone. Imagine that events are characterized by their views and their differences. That's a relational perspective. Now, it's a commonplace that events that are nearby have similar views. Everybody in this audience has a similar view of the universe because you're near each other. But could that be backwards? Could be that events are nearby because their views are similar, and the real metric that underlies the universe is the similarity of viewpoints, as the similarity of information coming to an event up their backward light cone. So let's take that as a hypothesis, that similar events are near to each other in a certain metric, which is the real metric. And sometimes, often, at the classical level, that corresponds to the emergent metric geometry of space. Sometimes things are close to each other, events are close to each other. I'm close to you because if we looked out at the sky, we would see very similar views. But there are cases where there are events or systems that see similar views, but they're very far away from each other. And that, I want to claim, and this is what we speculated about with Julian a long time ago, is the origin of quantum phenomenon. And that's what I'm going to argue for you. Now, just a minute for a philosophy, blah, 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 but please don't leave the room, even if you're allergic to philosophy, blah, blah, blah. Because it supports the view that I'm developing. I've asked you to contemplate some very bizarre views. Now I'm going to do some philosophy, blah, 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 about the principle of the identity of the indiscernible. This says that any two events or objects with isomorphic relational properties, and of course, if you're a Leibnizian, all properties of physical systems are relational. That is, they're about interactions with other systems. So two events or objects with isomorphic relational properties that should be identified. But now we're going a little further, and we're suggesting that events with similar relational properties are near to each other and can interact with each other in a certain metric. Now, I just point out that this has a consequence, and I just say this to because I can take advantage of furthering the discussion with Lucien. In a world where the principle of the identity of the indiscernible were strictly true, there would be no global symmetries, because a global symmetry takes you between two states which takes events to other events which have the same views by virtue of that global symmetry. And if any two such events are to be identified, then there is no global symmetry. The space-time with the Minkowski metric shrinks to one event. It's just a degenerate case and shrinks to one event. I claim this is verified in the formulation of general relativity. For example, you can show, as Karol Kukoc did in the early 70s, that general relativity, seen as a theory on its configuration space, has no global symmetries and therefore no conservation laws. This is for the spatially compact case. I already mentioned relative locality, but let me take it further. If localization is a consequence of having a unique view, and nearby localization or being in interaction is a consequence of having a similar view, then distance is a consequence. I'm just repeating this and showing you that it kind of draws out from the identity of the indiscernibles. Distance is a consequence of having dissimilar views, that is, dissimilar relations with your causal neighborhood. So let's make a hypothesis that the fundamental geometry of the world is built from distinctiveness based on causal neighborhoods. Distance is not a reason for having dissimilar causal neighborhoods, it's a consequence of having dissimilar causal neighborhoods. And this really just repeats the speech I made before about defects in causal geometry. But let me suggest that if there's an interaction between two events which have similar causal paths, that interaction, if it's to protect the principle of the identity of the indiscernible, must be repulsive. It must make it less likely that the events will become more similar, more likely that they'll become distinct. So the picture is that interactions come from similarity of causal neighborhoods, and those interactions have to be at the shortest scale repulsive to keep the principle of identity from being eliminated. Now, I'm going to give you a model that realizes this idea precisely, and this repulsive interaction is going to turn into the Bohmian potential. That's the bottom line of this talk. But those of you, I hope that there are enough Bohmian knowledgeable people here. The Bohmian potential is what, from the Bohmian point of view, distinguishes classical from quantum mechanics. So here's a kind of way to put it. This was a kind of joke that we developed in some work about causal sets with Marina Cortez. We actually argue that the principle of the identity indiscernible forces the world to be non-deterministic on short scales. Supposing you have two events with identical causal paths. That can happen in nature, especially if there's a microscopic scale where the neighborhoods are very simple, where there are just a few things happening in their recent causal paths. Supposing that there are two neighborhoods with an identical recent causal path, then their causal futures had better not be identical, or they would be a violation of the principle of the identity of the indiscernible. So there has to be that with the same causal past, you have different causal futures. Therefore, there's not a law that deterministically connects your causal past to your causal future. And that, we argued with Marina, very much as a kind of joke, but now in the model I'm going to show you, it becomes realized dynamically, is the origin of quantum fluctuations and quantum randomness. Okay, so that's all the blah, blah, blah. I've taken 15 minutes of blah, blah, blah. Now we're going to have half an hour of stating some precise assumptions from which I'm going to build the model, and then I'm going to derive quantum mechanics from the model, and then I'm going to derive some deviations from quantum mechanics that experimentalists might look for. So here are my four assumptions. First, I won't use this, but I have to say this because otherwise somebody will ask about it. Quantum mechanics is seen here to be a description of subsystems of the universe because it has to do with the distinctiveness of subsystems with respect to other subsystems. There ain't no such thing as quantum cosmology. There is some cosmological theory, and quantum mechanics is an approximation to it for small subsystems, but it's not formulated in the language of quantum mechanics. Then I make two hypotheses. The first is I call the real ensemble hypothesis. Imagine now I have some atomic system which has very few properties. So it's going to be similar to other atomic systems far away from it just by having few properties and there being lots and lots. Consider a hydrogen atom in its ground state. There are lots of other hydrogen atoms in the universe in their ground state. So let's put them together and make them an ensemble. They're causally similar. They will differ with respect to their hidden variables or their beables, but they have similar constituents, similar dynamics, similar contexts, and similar preparations. So let's put them together in an ensemble. I'm going to make the hypothesis that those ensembles of similarly prepared systems in the universe constitute the quantum state. That is, as Einstein suggested, the quantum state refers to an ensemble of systems. But unlike Einstein's suggestion, we're going to insist that that ensemble consists of systems that really exist in nature. And because of the blah, blah, blah that I gave you initially, all those systems are in interaction with each other. And that interaction is going to result in the Bohmian quantum potential. I know it sounds bizarre, but don't leave the room yet. You can leave, you're already standing. I hope it's pressure. But it's already written what I'm going to say next. So. Okay, I explored this idea in a paper about 3 years ago, but this is a better version of it. The basic hypothesis is that these similar systems that make up this ensemble have an interaction with each other by virtue of their similarity. And I'm going to posit that interaction, and it's going to, as I said, derive in the Bohmian potential. Now, the difference between the old work and the real ensemble hypothesis and the present work is some very interesting work that I saw a few months ago on what's called the many classical worlds in interaction view, which we're going to have a talk about tomorrow. Can I advertise your talk at 3:30? This theory posits that our universe is one of a large number of classical universes which have a large number of copies, of which we're one, but we don't know which one, so we have to apply statistical reasoning, and that these copies of the universe are all in interaction with each other. This is the same math, but with a different blah, blah, blah attached to it, because my ensemble is not coexisting universes, but coexisting similar systems physically distant from each other. But the math is the same. And the math that I'll show you is a refinement of the mathematics in the paper that you'll be describing tomorrow. Okay. Now, to find that math, I'm going to refer to a principle that Julian Barber and I formulated in that time 30-something years ago, which we call the principle of maximal variety. We consider a system of relations like a graph. The variety of the graph is a measure of the distinctiveness of its subsystems. And I'm going to give you a precise definition in a moment. Now this, we had two purposes for, one of which was to use as a measure of complexity in studies of complex self-organizing systems. The other was as a fundamental principle that the world should have as much of this quantity of variety as possible. And we hypothesized then but that would lead to quantum mechanics. And that's what I want to show you. The interaction that I'm going to posit between these similar subsystems is based on this notion of variety. So consider a graph G representing a system of relations like in the picture there. Consider two nodes of the graph and consider their first neighborhood. Their first neighborhood is the nodes one step away and the connections between them. The second neighborhood is the node two steps away and the connections between them and so forth. define the distinctiveness between those two nodes as being the number of steps you have to go before the neighborhoods are different from each other. So every two nodes has a distinctiveness, Nij. Or rather, consider its inverse, because the smaller n is, the more distinct they are, the less information, you see, I will use that word, the less information you need to distinguish those two nodes. Sum that over all pairs and normalize it, and that's the variety of the graph. That's the concept that Julian and I developed. There are some graphs with high variety. There's another, it's interesting that the graphs which occur often in studies of sociological systems or complex systems or biological systems have high variety if you measure them. Those are graphs with low variety because you have to go a long way. You have to get to boundary effects before you can distinguish nodes from each other by their neighborhoods. Did you get the concept? Now we're going to consider an application of it. So consider a system consisting of n subsystems. Okay, and we're going to assume for simplicity not that they're described by graphs, although in the quantum theory of gravity they might be, but that they're just described by points in a vector space. So I have a d-dimensional vector space, xA, and I have d vectors in the vector space corresponding to my n systems. And the vector space will have a metric. Here's the blah, blah, blah. The way to define the view of a system then, the view of the ith system, is the vectors to the other systems normalized by the distance. So that summarizes the information, what the rest of the system looks like from the ith system. It's the vectors to the other systems, the difference vectors, normalized by the distance. The distance, you might just take the norm squared of the distance. I'm going to have to cut that off at some large distance. So there's some distance after which you don't come into the view of somebody else. Okay. We again consider the distinctiveness. The larger the differences of these views are, the more distinct the pair of subsystems are, the more different their view of the rest of the system. And sum this over all pairs and normalize, and that's the variety. That's going to be the potential energy. We're going to study a system which has that dynamics given by that potential energy. Now, that has dimensions of 1 over length squared. So to make it into an energy, we need an h bar squared over m. And I'm anticipating where I'm going. So I'm going to multiply that by h bar squared over 8m and a minus sign, because I want the ground state to be the one that maximizes the variety. So the potential energy is the ninus of the variety times constants. Now, if I want to make a dynamical system of this classically, I would introduce momenta conjugate to these position vectors. But here I've been beat up a lot mentally and an email by, again, Anthony Valentini, who convinces me we should really take seriously Wahlstrom's objection to a bunch of, and here an email, I was on the other side of this until recently. But the point of this is that momentum densities in quantum mechanics are gradients of a function. And that means they satisfy a lot of relations because when you integrate around a node, you have to get an integer. And so rather than introducing conjugate momentum variables, I'm going to just introduce a phase variable, that is each system has a complex phase, which I'll sometimes write as W, then it's a complex phase, and I'll sometimes write as S, but when I write it as S, remember that it's only defined up to units of 2 pi n h bar. Now, the natural momenta to construct out of these phases is constructed this way, using the views. This is what would become the momenta if I just asked for a quantity conjugate to those views. So we're going to take this to the momenta and square it, divide by 2m and sum, and that's going to be the kinetic energy of my model. And there are various normalization constants around I'll discuss in the discussion if people want those details. to write an action, I have to write P dot times X. Now you might think, why isn't that PX dot? And that's because of some blah, blah, blah about relative locality, in which we've come to think that X is really the momentum of P, so it's XP dot. And that turns out to be necessary to get the quantum theory to come out right for some mysterious reason. So here's the action that defines my dynamics. There's a Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is the sum of the kinetic energy I just defined, the potential energy coming from the principle of variety, and some other potential energy acting within each subsystem. Well, that's going to be the standard potential energy. Okay? So that's the hypothesis as to what the real system underlying quantum theory is. Okay, that's the dynamical system we can study. And we can study it in various approximations. And a natural approximation is to study it when n, the number of subsystems, is large. So now there follows 5 slides of derivation. I don't expect to, in the 10 minutes that I have left, to teach the details. But all the details are on the slide, so I will just point out the high points as we go by, okay? We have a finite number of subsystems, so if I have an observable phi, which is a function of these coordinates of the subsystems, I would find the average by dividing by n and summing over phi of x. I turn that into an integral of a function over a probability distribution rho of z. So in other words, rho summarizes where the subsystems are in their configuration spaces. This is standard. What's also standard is that if I sometimes have to sum over 2 indices, over k and I, for example, in the definition of the variety, I have to sum over 3, and we'll turn that into an integral over the difference times the density at the point x away from z, and whatever property is that's defined both at z and x from z. And the important thing is I have to put on limits of integration to correspond to the discrete system, to recognize that n is large but finite, and rho is normalized. And this is where all the work happens, is in fitting these limits of integration to make the discrete system correspond to the continuum system. And what you have to do, I won't give the details of how you justify it, is that the lower limit of integration here has to be inversely proportional to the dth root of rho and n. First of all, that's dimensionally correct, but secondly, that's because that's where your nearest neighbor will be if the density is rho in their n systems. And this I learned from your papers, from the many interacting classical universes. This is the most important thing I got from your papers, apart from the idea, which... Yeah, and all this comes from trying to generalize to multiple dimensions, which you'll see is the point here. The upper limit of integration turns out to have to scale by 1 over n, by n to 1 over n to the 1 over d power, giving you a physical scale r prime. So we're going to consider large n with r prime held fixed. And why is that? I would have to tell you in the discussion, but otherwise things don't turn, it's not possible to normalize things correctly so that they make any physical sense. Okay. So we make using those tools, we make a continuum approximation to the variety and the other expressions. We expand, there are, for example, many cases where there are the densities at different points. We're integrating over the distance x from the main point z, and we expand in derivatives. Those derivatives bring down powers of a, and remember that a goes like 1 over n to the dth root. So that's how we organize things in powers of 1 over n. We expand and we normalize, and the leading term is a constant, which diverges as n is large. The first non-constant term is this, gradient of rho over rho squared. And that turns out to be bang on the head what you need for the Bohmian quantum potential. That's the whole point. plus corrections which scale with higher powers of 1 over n to the dth root. You can do the same thing to the kinetic energy. Again, I'm skipping details. You pull out the gradient of S squared times rho, plus higher order terms in N. So the Hamiltonian looks like gradient of S squared over 2m, this term that gives the Bohmian quantum potential, plus the usual potential, plus things that are going away for large r prime. Sorry, I missed the prime in large n. The symplectic structure goes through the same way. And I won't belabor you why you needed the p dot rather than the x dot. And you finally end up with an action representing the probability, dynamics of the probability distribution, to the integral of rho over this quantity S dot that comes from the symplectic structure, and then the Hamiltonian. You vary by rho and S. This is now, you're now in very well-known territory. This is not new. You get the law of probability conservation, and you get the Hamilton-Jacobi equation corrected by the Bohmian quantum potential. And that, it's well-known, are the real and imaginary parts of the Schrodinger equation. So quantum mechanics, so all my fancy blah, 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 plus the particular hypothesis about the interactions between the distinct systems results to leading order and n in the Schrodinger equation. Okay, I think I have about 10 minutes. Is that right? Five, okay. I was pushing. There's actually one more step. Because rho, the probability distributions I've been talking about, is the ensemble probability distribution. And we don't measure the ensemble probability distribution. We measure the particular hydrogen atom in our atom, or the particular qubit in our atom trap here. So there has to be an ergodic phenomenon or a thermalization by which the probability distributions for each member of the ensemble through their interactions become the one probability distribution for the ensemble. And I have nothing to say about that. That's a complex problem in statistical mechanics, but it's a well-known kind of problem, and I'll assume that it works through. Since I only have 5 minutes, I'll just give you a taste of the rest of the talk. Quantum statistics goes through. This is really here because there's a unpleasant discussion from some philosophers of physics about how the identity of the indiscernible is in conflict with bosonic quantum mechanics. So you can show that if you discuss identical particles as a case here and you demand that the probability distribution and their time derivatives are independent of the order in which you write the dependence on the identical particles, you can only end up with bosonic or fermionic statistics. And this makes use of the fact that the degree of freedom, the conjugate degree of freedom, is a phase factor. The measurement problem is solved here because microscopic systems are quantum systems according to this philosophy because they're similar to many, many other systems in the universe, and therefore they fall into ensembles where they have these interactions amongst them. If you're a large complex system, you're in an ensemble of one. There are no copies of you and no similar systems to interact with. So you have only the fundamental dynamics, which is deterministic, to describe your evolution. So there's no mystery about why we and cats are classical and are not subject to quantum statistics and are not described by quantum states. Those quantum states describe large ensembles that only apply for microscopic systems that suffer from this issue of similarity. There's more to say about that. You can ask, how can a macroscopic system be made up of microscopic systems that are quantum if it's not quantum, and things like that. And that's addressed in the first paper I wrote about the real ensemble formulation. Okay, I think I just have one more thing to say, which is a little, 3 slides on experimental tests. It goes without saying, and you must have understood by now, is very recent work in progress. So this is not as specific as I'd like it to be, but this is to open up a dialogue with experimenters. First, let's look at nonlinear corrections to the Schrodinger equation. The first nonlinear correction to that potential constructed from the variety, I'll call delta V. Delta V is delta of the variety, and it has this form. It's the second derivative of rho over rho squared. It comes with a positive power of that large scale R prime, which therefore gets physical significance, and is suppressed by 1 over n to the 2d. This gives a correction to the quantum potential, delta q, which I'll show in the next slide, so that the Hamilton-Jacobi equation is further modified by a more complicated function of derivatives of rho. This, by the way, doesn't affect the probability conservation law. So probability conservation is maintained. It's a way of modifying quantum mechanics that maintains probability conservation. Well, what to do with this experimentally? If this were huge, it would be a disaster, but the presumption is that the coefficient is small, although it's the ratio of two large things. So depending on things that we don't know enough about, it might be sizable. In any case, one can do perturbation theory. To first order, it corrects energy eigenvalues, so therefore might show up in precision measurements like the Lamb shift, for example. And I haven't done the full calculation, but I've done the estimate by orders of magnitude. And assuming we're applying it to an atomic system, here is the shift, the delta E over E. It's order R prime squared, which is again some large distance scale, over the Bohr radius squared over n to the d over 2. And so that's left as a query to experimentalists. If we could study some molecule where d is relatively large, so even if n is huge, the dth root comes down, maybe one could start to see effects like that. The other way to look for experimental effects is to try to construct in the laboratory systems which are mesoscopic, which are built, for example, from a large number of interacting qubits that might normally be thought to be in some entangled state, and try to see if one can measure deviations from quantum behavior. And there are some issues to discuss, which we can discuss in the discussion. So thank you very much.
I guess why pick variety? What's stopping me from picking any? I mean, you have x, the position, the distance, and you're saying, well, I don't want to think of that as the distance. I want to instead think about it as something else, in this case, the variety. But why couldn't I pick anything to be that thing and then just say, I mean, you have an identification of distance with something, and then you kind of choose some conjugate variable, which is now your kinetic energy. I'm just wondering why you can't do that with. Why variety? Why not just say,
it turns out,
very
no, it's a very good question. It turns out, and here I'll defer to the work on many interacting universes. It turns out you need a three-body interaction. No, that's what you guys found. You just did the one-dimensional case, but you had to, in order to get the derivative of rho over rho squared to come out, you need it to be a three-body interaction. You need a system to look at two neighboring systems and compare itself to two neighboring systems. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh, that's exactly what we're doing with the variety. So it's an opportunity to develop an idea. It's not the only development of the idea one can imagine. There are a lot of choices for how you might parameterize the variety. The most important thing that came out of the detailed analysis is the need to fix this upper scale. Because it doesn't come out in quantum mechanics, but it comes out if one wants to explore deviations from quantum mechanics. So I don't want to claim there's more than here. There's a line of thought which leads to a suggestion, but there are lots of nearby other things that one might study, and if this is interesting to anybody, you're welcome to study it.
Why do you pick this conjugate variable and say that's the kinetic energy? What kind of allows you, or why say that? I mean, I know if it was really distant, I would know why I would want to consider the momentum to be the conjugate variable and put it in the kinetic energy. But here, why do you say that this way is, leads you to something which should go into the kinetic energy?
It's reverse engineering, but there is a lot of freedom. I know there's lots of things like this in which quantum mechanics is derived from some hypotheses about separating out to real and imaginary parts. And all of them, if you formulate an action principle, there's a rho S dot term. And P is like the gradient of S. So up to an embarrassing derivative, which you don't know what to do with at first, you have an X P dot. And then you have where does the X come from and where does that derivative come from? And that was answered by sticking in the view there. So it's a reverse engineering to get to come out the simplest possible thing, which will lead to the Schrodinger equation.
So only to prevent you to ask the same question tomorrow in my talk. I mean, here we derived, like, for example, a complex value by the Schrodinger equation. Do you see any way, for example, to do a similar thing with spinners, for example, like C4 spinners or so?
I haven't thought about that as the best thing to say. In the previous instance, the paper from a few years ago about real ensemble formulation, I did it in such a way that it would apply also to matrix mechanics and maybe apply to spinners, but I haven't had the time to think. Let's discuss.
So you have a preferred time? Formulation.
Yes.
So I guess A, what's your attitude towards that, and B, these corrections, do they lead to signaling?
So let me take the last one first. Possibly yes. I don't know, but I presume so. Generally, when you stick a nonlinear function of sidebar psi into the Schrodinger equation like that, it does. Because of what happens when you take direct products to make composite systems, you generally don't separate things out cleanly and you get signaling. So I haven't checked it, but I would expect that that issue arises here. My attitude towards preferred frames has flipped over the years. I used to be a big believer in the principle of relativity, especially general relativity and the gauge transformations of what are called refoliation or many finger time. And under the influence of Tim and Julian and his friends, with the development of shape dynamics, I've become convinced that the deeper formulation of general relativity is one that has a preferred slicing. And that also, I've also come to, by a long evolution, to believe in the reality of the present and the unreality of the future. And that's a long discussion, but I've written two books about that, so you can find the discussion written down. If there is to be an objective difference between the past, present, and the future, then that means there's an objective difference between the past, present, and the future. So if you have other reasons to believe that, unless you want to really tie yourself up in conceptual knots, it's easier just to believe in a preferred slicing, which plays a role in global physics, but doesn't come into local observables. Yeah, Tim?
So, because you just said that you want the difference between the past, present, and future, does your dynamics increase variety?
So you use
variety as the potential for your sample, but does it actually increase the variety in the ensemble? Because that would then be what you discern. You would say the future has more distinct systems than the past.
I haven't thought that through, but that sounds like another thing that would be interesting to think about.
I have more of a comment. I'm coming very much from an information theory background. But it's very interesting that you talked about the distance between two events as being measured by their distinguishability.
Mm-hmm.
Information geometry does precisely that. It measures the differences by the distinguishabilities used as a measure of distance, the distinguishability of the probability distribution. And if one formulates quantum mechanics as a form of entropic dynamics, the quantum potential is coming from the Fisher-Rao information metric. So although this is a very different approach in that it's not purely ontic, it contains ontic and epistemic elements, the notions of distinguishability come in both.
Thank you. That's very good to hear. I wish I knew more about that, but I will look at your papers again. Thank you.
The other comment is that you mentioned the Wallstrom objection. I have over the years been bombarded by the same objection, and I believe that Wallstrom is very, very right in making it. And if one formulates these kind of theories for fermions, it turns out to be the case that these phases are actually angles. So once one does this kind of theory for a fermion, the theory is cleaned up.
Okay. Can you give me a later reference for that?
No, not yet. Oh. I haven't published it yet.
Okay. Great, okay. Thank you.
Let's move on. So let's thank
you very much.